morning, Honourable Chair. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to present to the committee this morning. Just to give an overview of our presentation, firstly to say that we're fully supportive of the need to strengthen and address the shortcomings of the existing Rental Housing Act. In particular, we support attempts to strengthen and improve the efficiency of the rental tribunal, the need for increased levels of transparency in respect of lease agreements, improve landowner tenant lease governance and processes, and attempts to improve hygiene practices and minimum standards as far as rental housing is concerned. We do, however, have a couple of material concerns, such as we think there could be some potential unintended consequences of this proposed amendment bill, and we would like to make some concluding technical suggestions to the committee. I think if we look at our material concerns, I think the first one, the proposed amendment to Section 2, paragraphs 5 and 6 of the amendment bill, which talks to vulnerable families. Our concern is not the attempt to put this into the bill, but rather the fact that what we already have is a whole lot of legislative frameworks that frame what the department can and cannot do. And I think a lot of that guidance comes out of PIE, where there's been a number of legal outcomes, two of which have actually been in front of the Constitutional Court, and the other one which has been in front of the Supreme Court of Appeal. And essentially, if you look through the seven cases which we highlight in our presentation, you will see that by and large, changes to the amendment bill and all regulations put in by the minister will have little or no effect. We think the framework has already been set, and there's a clear test history around these. And I think if what we have here is a piece of legislation which is intended to be positive and to strengthen rental housing in our country, and I think if there is attempts through this amendment bill to shift more responsibility from the state to the private sector, what you will have is unnecessary court challenges and cost for the state, because these matters have already been to the Constitutional Court in some instances. What you could see is landlord flight from rental into home ownership models if they perceive this to be a threat, and this will impact particularly on inner cities and coastal areas. It could induce the private sector to spurn further rental stock investment, and this comes at a time when the department has identified that rental is increasingly an important form of tenure, and that there's an acute shortage of rental stock, especially within the gap and affordable housing market segment. We think this could be a burden for landlords, because lenders could perceive this to be increase the risk profile of landlords, and they put up their finance costs and the different ease of which landlords are able to access loans from lenders would become more difficult. And then I think the last point, which for me is quite an important one, is that the intention of the state is really is to protect the vulnerable. What we've seen with PIE in the past is that unscrupulous tenants and or criminals have used that framework to actually frustrate a landlord's ease of eviction and or their ability. It's allowed them to hijack buildings, especially in the inner city of Johannesburg. So what are our recommendations? Our recommendations are that we would like to suggest that the committee considers removing Section 2, paragraph 5 and 6 of the amendment bill, and that if the state is looking to strengthen the plight of the vulnerable, that one puts this into the Social Housing Act as opposed to the Rental Act, because we think the framework is there which would negate any efforts in that regard. I think there is an opportunity, though. Back in 2007, when the Human Rights Commission held public hearings on evictions, they promoted three things. First of all, they promoted a review of government's policy of not only assisting first-time home buyers. What they were suggesting there is that whilst you have beneficiaries who need support to get into housing. Similarly, at the back end, you have families that get into vulnerable and conditions where their trust requires the state to actually support them further. It was suggested that municipalities provide accommodation for those that are destitute and that they put that into RDPs. I think what we have seen since that recommendation is the Constitutional Court ruling that it is the responsibility of municipalities to actually provide alternative accommodation for destitute families. And then something which we think is quite creative was the need for a loss of income cover as part of the social security system. As the private sector, we look at trying to put in loss of income cover into our housing arena, but the cost of that was prohibitively expensive, so it actually pushed low-income households. It created an affordability problem within, but there could be an opportunity around our social security system for that. What we did back, and I'll make this note, in 2008 is we actually piloted a project with Gauteng Government and Joburg Metro around the vulnerable families that had acquired homes, got into financial difficulties and were staring at eviction, where we actually put a process in place to actually fix the problem. It was a successful pilot. We tried to get national to adopt it, but of course the needs for first-time home buyers overrode those needs. The second material concern we wish to highlight is around the tenant deposit. We obviously welcome that insertion in the bill, but what we would like to see is some form of preferred creditor protection for the tenant's deposit. And I think if we're looking at a recommendation, we would suggest that it's inserted into the bill and that the Estate Agents Act could provide the committee with some form of a framework of how to actually put something like this in to protect tenants. The third point, material point we'd like to make is around the transition period. When we look at the amendment bill, it makes no provision for a transition period or clarity in respect of existing leases. And we would like to suggest that a clause should be put into this effect, and that obviously in terms of contract one has to be used, that it shouldn't be retrospective or applied to existing leases. The fourth material concern is around regulations through extension of the amendment bill, where the minister has the right to create regulations as far as norms and standards without any form of public consultation. There are a number of hygiene factors in there which we're obviously very supportive of, but there are three areas that we are concerned with: the one around affordability, the one around contract, and select and differing standards on a geographic area by geographic area basis. At this point in time, we don't know what the regulations are, so we're making assumptions, and we're suggesting that it could impact on contract and affordability, and that it could be an attempt to cap or reduce rental for the vulnerable. We think it's untenable that the minister can create regulations without any form of public consultation. Geographic area-based, differing geographic area-based regulations, I think, is problematic because what it can do is promote patching rental stock across the country, and it could actually frustrate government's intentions because all you will have is landlords taking flight to areas where the regulations are less onerous. And then I think the last point for us is it could impact on the viability of rental stock and the investors, and you know they need to include in this affluent families who buy holiday cottages and so on. And obviously mortgagees have quite a large exposure to this, so these obviously point of concern to ourselves. Our recommendation therefore is to remove that subsection 1 FB1. We think that there should be uniform norms and standards across the country. We think there should be public consultation. Moving over to the technical concerns, we only have two or four here. Our first concern is around 3642, where it talks about the obligations and rights of the landlord. We're just suggesting that the wording should, instead of using the word repossess, what we should perhaps look at putting in is the landlord right of time and order of eviction from the court. It's not really in possession. Amendment of Section 10 of the bill. The one thing that for us was missing was the right for an MEC being able to appoint an alternative chair. If there is the alternative chair and the existing chair is either unavailable or they wish to have a simultaneous second tribunal, you can't do that without the MEC having appointed an alternative chairperson. So our recommendation is that there should be a little clause in the sense of that. And that's it from us. I'm happy to field any questions that the committee or anyone might have for us.
Thank you very much. That was spot precise. Straight and fit. I think before the members can we address the issue of the alternative chair? Because the MEC appoints the chairperson, and then the committee, the tribunal itself, will appoint the deputy chair. Maybe we can look at those delegated responsibilities, but we'll look at it. Then on the issue of the regulation, while we are emphasizing that we need to have a regulation by the minister, it's because we want a uniform standard, then I think that one we appreciate that. But at the same time, the current practice, the regulations before the department promulgates the regulations, the public hearings are being held, you are going to get that opportunity, and those regulations, before they are promulgated by the minister, gazetted by the minister, they come before the portfolio committee. So you are 100% secured on that one. But the issue of PIE, I think we have been interacting with the department on this matter. We understand that there are loopholes in the act itself, and the department is in the process of trying to look at those loopholes. But at the same time, we must agree that when we say we pass the laws, it is important for Parliament to evaluate the impact of those laws. So that is the process that we have started. Because what we have observed that the PIE Act is supposed to be implemented at the local level, at the local government level, because those checks, they don't just manage up there. You'll find those checks at the local level. So the weakness of the legislation itself, there are no mechanisms that are assisting the local government in making sure that within that 72, I'm not sure what 72 hours, what is the assistance that is going to be provided in terms of making sure that there is a capacity within the municipalities. Because it's expensive to appoint those security, what you call these people who are around him. Yes. So there has to be a need to make sure that how is this legislation going to be implemented. Otherwise, PI Act is fine, but there are some loopholes that need to be addressed. So, Honourable Members, it's your time. Honourable Sosibo, Honourable Tole, Honourable Omen, Honourable Kalaba, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got only two questions, just for clarity. It's the one as with regard to the laws of income cover. Is it not going to push up the rent and where are the people going to get money? Another one is with regard to the deposit. Do you have maybe in mind the percentage that you put
all, we want to thank. First of all, Chair, we want to thank the input from the association. By mine, I don't. Chair. Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to thank them for this submission. But my mind is just few, Chair. The first one which I want to get the input from them, or their intake about this. They are talking about the overcrowding and the affordability. What is their intake when they are talking about this one? And the last one, Chair, is that one of the first time home owners. What is their views on that one? Thank you.
Thank you. I want to just thank you very much for your presentation, and I note your concern. I think it was a concern of ours to get the balance right as well. You know, you want to protect the tenant, you want to protect the landlord. So it's a bit of a difficult one. I just want to refer to your this arm's length trust account. I thought that was quite a good point. Is that something which is out there being used? If you could just give us something on that. Otherwise, I think your submissions are quite clear, and we appreciate them. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chair. I think let me echo the sentiments of my colleagues and welcome your presentation. I think it was quite concise and very direct and straight to the point. And it definitely had some very good innovative solutions to some of the loopholes we're trying to close here. But you see, in essence, this bill is about addressing three very critical market into the property market, your gap market, which we've got a serious headache on how to deal with, and your students and the vulnerable. Those are the consumers of rental bill, of your rental stock. So in addressing debt, that is why you will see us having debt, because of linked to this is the issue of the PIE Act. And I know that, you know, when it comes to the PIE Act is the issue of, you know, your urban slums that are always cropping up. And that is where you'd be very much involved as a banking sector. But I would like to ask you in terms of the review of government policy to assisting first-time home buyers, because I view the entry of the first-time home buyers in order to build their credibility would be to somehow rent something so that the bank can trace the credit record of a particular person. How do you see, can you unpack that one for us? Secondly is the issue of provision of alternative housing, provision. How can we make sure that we provide alternative housing by making sure that this three market I prefer to understand the value of rental stock as a means towards accumulating property wealth and as a means to entering the market. And just talk on the issue of the burden for landlords and the impact on the private sector per se. Because of, as my colleague was saying, we're trying to make a balancing act here. You know, we don't want to chase away the private sector in terms of rental stock. But on the other hand, we don't want the vulnerable groups and the people who must enter the market for the first time to shy away from this. How can we merge the two to make sure that at the end of the day, everybody is happy in this regard? Thanks very much, Chair.
I think the first question we received was the loss of income cover, and there was a question around will it push up rent. It certainly would. As private sector, we try to actually design a product that actually prevent, that fix the problem where a family could afford to either rent a property or own a property, and then they lost their employment and they had no income and whatnot, and we found the costs were fairly prohibitive, and that what it would actually do is it would just increase the gap in the housing market from an affordability perspective. Back in 2005, we actually engaged with National Human Settlements and actually explored whether there wasn't perhaps an option for the state to actually look at it as part of their social security blanket for vulnerable families. And we're putting that back on the table, that maybe there is an option where all households, through some form or another, actually make a small little contribution towards it, let's say through UIF as an example, and that those families that are really vulnerable at a time when they lose their jobs can actually access a fund like this to protect themselves, certainly for a period of 6 months or whatever it is, that they don't actually end up being evicted onto the street. The question around what sort of deposit we are talking about between a landlord and a tenant, it's normally 1 or 2 months deposit that a tenant is required to give to the landlord. There is an existing framework, which is the Estate Agents Act, where an estate agent is required to have a fidelity certificate, but outside of that, any deposit that a consumer or home buyer makes has to go into a trust account. And I think it's actually quite an easy mechanism, a legal trust account, which actually protects that deposit. You could do it within your banking system quite easily, where a trust, I think the bill talks about the interest must equal at least that of a normal savings account, so it could be put into accounts in the banking system. You don't necessarily have to go through lawyers to actually achieve that. The estate agents already have trust accounts that actually sit within the various banks and branches. The issue around overcrowding is a big problem, and I think the bill tries to strengthen the position where landlords shouldn't abuse tenants. So overcrowding is something that we certainly don't like, we don't agree with. There is obviously an issue around affordability, and I think the one point raised was around students and whatnot, and they do get abused, and I think that we should be looking at those hygiene factors, as I said in our presentation, that we actually prevent landlords from abusing tenants. We don't think that's right. First-time home buyers and our views around that. Clearly, a family's ability to get into the property ladder and to acquire wealth from property ownership is obviously government's priority, as is the vulnerables and the poor of our country. That is what government focuses on. What we were trying to propose was that you do have families that get into financial difficulty or hardship, although they've been in housing for many, many years, and they are again vulnerable, and that there isn't the possibility of the state getting involved to assist those families. In our pilot that we did, in the whole of Johannesburg Metro, and we created a very tight definition of what is vulnerable. It was people that were disabled, aged, and so on. We only had 1,500 test cases in the whole of Joburg Metro with all the problematic properties that the bankers had that actually qualified in terms of the word vulnerable. And I'd be happy to provide our definition of what we used as vulnerable in that test case. And it was quite successful in actually assisting those families. The state took a bit of a knock. Where it provided a subsidy, the municipality took a bit of a knock, where it wrote off arrears in rates and taxes and so on, and the banks took a knock in terms of any residual debt that was there. But we actually looked to actually safeguard those vulnerable families. The issue around the balance between a landlord and a tenant, what we were trying to suggest in our presentation is that balance is there already, and there's already a legal framework in place which has been tested in the Constitutional Court that the department could write anything into this amendment bill, but it's going to be overridden. It's going to end up being in a court case which will cost the state, because two of the matters have already been to the Constitution, and we've detailed the commentary around it, but the one which also talks to it went to the Supreme Court of Appeal, where it actually said that they thought that there was a balance, and the Constitution said exactly the same thing, and it also protected the landowner's rights. Their property rights place a landlord outside of Section 26(3) of the Constitution, and that was a recent constitutional ruling. So we're just suggesting that the framework is there, and that balance is already there to actually protect the vulnerable, and the courts have to take that into consideration, but not at the expense of the landlord, at the expense of the municipalities who are required to provide that alternative accommodation. I've spoken about the Trust account, Nikki. I think I've answered the plight of students and the vulnerable. How do we make sure that we promote alternative options? The private sector will go where there's an opportunity and money to be made. And I think the more one legislates and the more you create an environment where you constrain the private sector, the less likely they are to go into that area. Clearly, from government's perspective, one needs to differentiate between social rental stock and commercial rental stock. What we've seen typically in the inner cities is a lot of the private sector companies are focusing on the gap and affordable housing markets with rentals of approximately R2,000-R2,500 a month, which is above government's social rental stock target market. But it very clearly fulfills a need where it's young families, where they're working in the inner city, there are pressures and security provided and whatnot. And I think that those landlords have been very successful in a lot of the inner cities of our country. And I think if that was our concern with this bill, is that if you try putting a whole lot of stuff around vulnerable people and trying to restrict their ability for the market to work effectively, what you're going to do is they're going to move out of rental, sell off those units, realize their capital investment, and then we've got a bigger shortage. Typically, I think one of the things that we should be doing in the gap market, and we should be thinking about it, is if we look at transfer costs in our country, they are restricted to properties worth R600,000 or more. What we do is we charge builders VAT on properties worth less than R600,000, and that includes rental stock. And it actually prejudices developers and or first-time buyers and or renters in the bottom end of the market because it pushes up those costs unnecessarily. I think that's a cost that could very easily be stripped out to make it more affordable, which I think was one of your questions as well, Councillor. How do we match the two? I think the legislative framework is there to balance it. There's a lot of cases that have been tested at constitution level. Courts have to take into consideration the plight of the vulnerable. Where we do have a gap, and I think it's a role that needs to be played a lot more aggressively, is municipalities need to create transitional stock. I think if we can get that stock in place, I think if we can get the unemployment insurance to cover vulnerable families in place, there is some temporary protection for these families. I think that's the balance. I don't think we're going to achieve that balance by trying to put anything into the bill. It's just going to end up in the courts and it's going to cost the state because it's been tested at constitutional level.
Thank you very much. I think there's a misunderstanding here on the issue of the vulnerable. What we need to realize here is that the rental sector does not really speak to the urban areas. Each and every town has got a rental stock. Even in rural areas, those teachers there, those nurses who are working on those clinics there, they are exposed to this to the sector. So we have to look both public and
private sector provision. The issue of the social housing, when we are saying let's push this to social housing, not all. Social housing cannot take all this rental stock. So government has got a responsibility to ensure that all the people are protected, those vulnerable people are protected. So maybe there may be the misunderstanding, whom are we referring to? Because the vulnerability is not only in the urban areas. It goes further to the rural areas. So we need to look at that. But at this stage, I'm going to request the legal unit on the issue of Section 2, why we insist that we need to have that section, as well as there's another recommendation by the association on the Section 1, SB1. Yes. So if you can unpack what are the views of the committee on that one. And then we would like to the association to provide us with this pilot project. It's very, we are impressed, it's very impressive, so that we assist to look at it with the department. At the same time, we need this we need this rental stock to be habitable. So I really appreciate what your recommendation there. Before Charmaine, Mama, please let's try and
I just think it might be useful also in view of the discussion on vulnerable people to perhaps get your description that you've worked on. I think that would help us tremendously when we are negotiating all of this thing.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'll be brief. On the question of the shifting of the responsibilities from the state to the private sector, this is in connection with evictions. When we know the law says if someone is evicted, then they cannot be evicted unless there is accommodation for them. Now, I wanted to find out, have you ever raised this before? Has this ever been raised before, say, with the department, for example? Because if, for instance, we look into this and we need to make changes, it's definitely going to affect a number of other issues. Has it ever been raised, or is it being raised for the first time?
Honourable Member, just to assist you, the PI Act amendment is underway. So we are going to discuss those issues under PI Act, those challenges there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In respect of Section 2, Subsection 5 and 6, the intention is not to affect private sector. This looks at the broader policy of government and how to bring that into play. So what we'll do is we will look at it and make sure that is clear from how the bill is drafted, that it does not affect the private sector. In respect of norms and standards and speaking about the regulations in sub-paragraph FB, the aspect there that this committee wishes to address is the fact that one of the big problems that has come to the attention of the committee is that landlords quite often would abuse the fact that a tenant might not only be poor, but might actually be uneducated, illiterate, etc. The person simply wants a roof over their head. And one of the example, I think, which is a very good example that our chairperson pointed out, was where a dwelling was let for 1,000 rand a month. When the landlord realized there were four or five people living there, it suddenly changed to 1,000 rand per person per month, which not necessarily equates to the value of the property. So The intention is not to limit what the private sector puts as a value on rental housing. And, of course, there will definitely have to be consultation, because should legislation come out that says you can only charge 500 rand per square meter per property, that will affect the right of the landlord in terms of the constitution. So there will be that kind of conflict, and that is not something that can be done, in fact. So that is not the intention. The intention is to stop abuse. And the lesson that we looked at was in Europe. There are certain norms and standards. A room must be 5 square meters, otherwise it's not a room. Things like that. So it is definitely something that I think is a step up for South Africa. It's not going to be easy for the department. It's going to be a hard job for the department to do the research when they bring these norms and standards out, because they will definitely be tested. So that is the intention.
I think the issue of the recommendation on page 6 bill should not be retrospective. It will depend, too, because those are issues currently. There are areas of abuse that we have observed through our oversight, a visit to the provinces. So there will be a need to revisit those leases. They must be aligned with the legislation. So we thank you very much, the banking sector, and we believe that this is not the first and the last interaction with the committee. You have got the responsibility to invite us or to request to come before the portfolio committee and present some of the issues you believe that they might be of interest to the human settlements sector. So you are not limited to this bill only, more especially that we have discovered that we have got a lot of work that we are doing up there. So we need to interact. And there was an agreement, I think it's still there, with the banking sector between the departments. So there are those interactions that are continuing, but you can come to us and share those issues. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.